Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, in Sochi Talks, Dr. Joseph Watrous with the University of Dayton offers us a fascinating history of racial desegregation in the Dayton public school system. Nikki Dakota talks with Russian teens who are here through an exchange program sponsored by the Miami Valley Episcopal Russian Network. Up first, WISO holds a rich digital archive from the civil rights era. In 2014, as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, we're partnering with community organizations to augment it with stories of local residents who lived through this transformational period in our history. Community Voices producer Jocelyn Robinson used the historical audio to inspire childhood recollections of the day when the streets of Yellow Springs looked more like the streets of Birmingham, Alabama.
We shall overcome, we shall overcome.
You're hearing archival audio recorded by WYSO News in September of 1963. It's Antioch College music professor Walter Anderson leading Yellow Springs residents in We Shall Overcome, the anthem of the civil rights movement. Over 400 people had marched through the village to mourn four little girls killed in a Southern church bombing and to strengthen their resolve to integrate a downtown barbershop.
We shall overcome someday.
In the weeks after the march, local protests were escalating in front of Lou Gegner's barbershop. WYSO News aired a special report that captured events as they happened.
All five demonstrators kept picketing, so Sheriff Bradley read the injunction.
And if you would cut the pickets to four, there will not be any arrests made. However, if this is not done, I have no other alternative.
The local civil rights demonstrators sang We Shall Overcome, the battle hymn of the integration movement. The National Association for the Advancement of White People countered with God Bless America. When no one dropped out of the picket line, all five demonstrators were arrested. They were loaded into a Yellow Springs police car for the trip to the Greene County Jail in Xenia.
Demonstrations continued, and on March 14, 1964, villagers and Antioch students were joined by students from nearby Central State and Wilberforce colleges. Hundreds of people lined the streets of Yellow Springs to bear witness to what was about to happen. Sterling Wright was a young teenager, and Bomani Moyenda was only 10 years old. Sterling, then Bomani, shared their memories of that day.
So I remember getting up in the morning and my parents telling me, don't go downtown because there's going to be problems. But I was 13 at the time. And myself and a lot of our friends were going to go down there anyway out of curiosity.
But I remember my mother taking my sister and I down there that day and standing and watching, and the students linked arm in arm, you know, across the street. I wasn't exactly sure what was going on, but I knew it was about this white man who refused to serve black customers.
So as we approached the town, me and a few of my friends, we started talking, and we were very well aware of what was going on in the United States. The demonstrations, the freedom riders, the lynchings, we were very, very well aware, and were very shocked that that could happen here in our hometown.
To see that many people occupying downtown and tension that was in the air, you know, to sense that and to hear the singing and the shouts of the protesters, you know, it was really intense.
It was so intense that officers in riot gear used nightsticks and fire hoses to break up the demonstrators. Villagers watching from the sidewalks fled, blinded and choking as tear gas billowed through the crowd. Abandoning nonviolence, some protesters actively resisted arrest, and over 100 people were hauled off to jail. Years of insistent but peaceful protests ended up in a race riot that was carried on the national evening news. The barber closed the shop that day, never to reopen, never to integrate. But the movement marched on. That summer, busloads of volunteers from all over the country headed for Mississippi to open freedom schools and register black voters. Congress passed the Civil Rights Bill in June, making integration the law of the land. The following spring, the drum major of the movement gave the commencement address at Antioch College, and the speech was taped by a WYSO reporter.
Those of us who live in the 20th century are privileged to live in one of the most momentous periods of human history. Indeed, we find ourselves standing between two ages, the dying old and the emerging new. An old age is passing away, and a new age is coming into being.
Now, nearly 50 years into the new age, Yellow Springs is considered a liberal haven in conservative Southwest Ohio. Yet many current residents have no knowledge of its civil rights legacy, no memory of its role in our nation's struggle for equality. Robin Jordan Henry, a member of the 365 Project, one of WYSO's partners in collecting oral histories to enhance the historical recordings, explains the importance of gathering and preserving stories like those of Sterling and Bomani.
We need their stories because we need to understand this village. We need to understand what people have gone through in order to make this village what it is now, or even keep working to make this village what it ought to be, what it purports itself to be. And also just for a more realistic view of who this village is.
Eventually, WYSO's archives and the oral histories will be available to researchers and scholars. But memories of pivotal events in our history belong to all of us. It's our shared story, whether you lived through it or not, and it shapes the character of our community, past, present, and future.
People should kind of use that incident as an anchor and really focus on the values that were present during that time, the values of social and racial justice, and really use that history and energy to focus on doing some anti-racism work on a personal level.
I think that going forward, if you forget the past, you have no future. I think that Yellow Springs is a sleeping giant. I do believe that the new community that moved here because of the good things that they wanted to see, that if we can charge them socially, that we can make some major changes here.
Hallelujah. For WYSO Community Voices and the Civil Rights Oral History Project, this is Jocelyn Robinson.
Jocelyn Robinson produced this piece in WYSO's Community Voices training course this year. Hear more tonight at 7 p.m. for part two of the 2013 Community Voices special and meet the new Community Voices producers, as well as course instructors Sarah Buckingham and Nina Ellis, at a special screenless screening at the Dayton Film Festival on Saturday, August 24th, 11 a.m. at the Neon Movies. So She Talks is a collaboration with the Southwest Ohio Council for Higher Education. It's an effort to bring Miami Valley research and thinking into the public arena, a way to enlighten the world with local knowledge. This week, our speaker is Dr. Joseph Watrous with the School of Education and Allied Professions at the University of Dayton. Today's topic, the fascinating history of racial desegregation of Dayton schools.
The plan was very simple. The racially homogeneous schools were on opposite sides of the river. And so the courtmaster simply paired elementary and secondary schools, which were about 4 or 5 miles apart, and sent some pupils from one school to another and vice versa. What was interesting, though, is that although it was very successful and had a high level of public support when it began, by 1986, public support changed so that in 2002, city and school officials complained that the program of busing caused white flight and did not increase the academic achievement of black students. Let's go back to 1954. And after the Supreme Court decision about separate schools, racially separate schools, that is, the superintendent in Dayton received a letter asking if there could be some change about the segregated nature of Dayton schools. He replied that they were not segregated. That was true in one sense, that is, there was no policy requiring black students to attend all black schools. However, in Dayton, school attendance boundaries followed neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods tended to be racially segregated. Now, that racial segregation in the neighborhoods stemmed from many reasons. One was that the Federal Housing Authority, which underwrote mortgages for homes, required that there be covenants in most homes, except those on the west side, which forbade the sale to minority group members. Therefore, neighborhood schools were tended to be one-race schools. For example, in 1962, when Dunbar High School opened, it had a student body of 99.6 African American. In September 1966, though, there was a new attitude in Dayton about segregation. This happened as a result of a shooting. White men riding in a car through the west side of Dayton shot an African-American man as he stood in front of his apartment. There was a riot that broke out in protest. Dayton's mayor created a committee to find ways to reduce those problems. Now, those difficulties, at least the segregation of the schools, should not have happened or could not, or at least they people worked to try to overcome those. In 1965, the U.S. Congress passed and Lyndon Johnson signed the U.S. Civil Rights Act, which warned that no person could suffer discrimination in a federally supported program. That led to the forcing of racial desegregation in most of the southern schools in a very short period of time. But that left the northern schools without any kind of effort to bring about desegregation. The Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP had begun a program of court decisions, a program of suits. In 1968, they won Green versus Schools of New Kent County, which decided that boards had to offer more than freedom of enrollment. That's the way Dayton had argued that they don't have segregated schools. It was available to anybody to move wherever they wanted. But what the court said was they have to show that people have actually used it. In Dayton, they had not. In 1972, in Keyes versus School District in Colorado, what the Supreme Court found was that a school board was guilty of mandating segregation if attendance zones created one-race schools. That was the case in Dayton, where attendance zones, in as much as they followed neighborhoods and the neighborhoods were segregated, then they were guilty of setting up segregated schools. Now, Wayne Carl was the superintendent, came to Dayton in 1969, and he worked towards getting desegregation in the schools. He had two supporters. One was the Dayton View Stabilization Program, which was headed by a gentleman named Joe Wine. And that program used a federally funded program, Multiple Motivation, to introduce quality education to neighborhoods which were undergoing transition. The second supporter, or the second group of supporters, came from administrators and teachers in Dayton Catholic schools. They had tried to desegregate their own schools, but had been unsuccessful, and they worked to try to support the desegregation of public schools. There were, at the same time, two major opponents of desegregation. One was on the west side, and this was a federally funded program of model cities. It was called the Model Cities Demonstration Program, and black power activists took control of this program, and they tried to prevent racial integration on the grounds that black people should control their own schools, and they had several programs in place that desegregation would weaken. The second were two people who resigned from Dayton schools. One had been an assistant principal. They created a political party serving our schools. They won seats on the school board. They won a majority in 1972, and they strove to retain neighborhood schools. Well, in 1972, the NAACP filed suit in U.S. District Court. They asked for metropolitan desegregation. Now, that would have prevented anybody from fleeing the Dayton schools to avoid desegregation, because it would have asked that all the surrounding schools, the suburban areas, Oakwood and Kettering and those schools, all participate in a desegregation program. But in 1974, the Supreme Court, in the case with Detroit, Milliken versus Bradley, argued that a court could not require desegregation involving suburban areas unless lawyers could show that the segregation that occurred as a result of those other districts was caused by officials, that if there was something that they had done purposefully to bring about segregation, there was no such proof possible. So that restricted the desegregation program to the city of Dayton alone. At any rate, in 1976, the buses rolled, school doors opened, and we had a very successful program. No violence, high rates of attendance, and no evidence of white flight. In 1986, though, things changed, and then the Supreme Court made a decision, Riddick versus School Board, which allowed school districts to dismantle court-ordered desegregation. And in April 2002, representatives from Dayton Schools, from the NAACP, and the Ohio Department of Education agreed to end efforts to bring about racial balance in the schools. Now, even though they had ended it, and they said that it was going to be an improvement or bring about an improvement in Dayton schools, it did not. Segregation increased and school problems remained. So from 2000 to 2004, at least 6 elementary schools increased enrollments of white students and 7 elementary schools increased enrollments of black students. Although there was some hope that the end of desegregation would bring about an improvement in academic achievement, it did not. In fact, in 2004, Dayton schools remained on the bottom of the state achievement scores for a third consecutive year. In 2006, the voters rejected a tax support, and a team of consultants from the Council of the Great City Schools who came to Dayton to see what the school board could do to improve the schools said, "This place is drifting and there's no plan for improvement." Well, one of the arguments for ending desegregation was that it had caused white flight. And that's a very interesting question, whether or not desegregation caused white flight. It should have been the case that if we end desegregation, then the white flight should have ended. It has not. It's continued on and probably will still continue. In 2003, the Miami Valley Regional Planning Commission hired consultants to do a survey of the Dayton City difficulties, or at least of this area. And what they found was that in Dayton, that most of the students in most of the schools, at least half, were on free lunch, which meant that they came from low-income families, or federally supported lunch programs, I should say. And that meant that they were from low-income families. In the suburban communities, that was not the case. And in Dayton, most of the students, at least a half of them, were from non-Asian minority families. That was not the case in the suburban areas either. Now, did desegregation itself cause the white flight? Now, that's an interesting question itself, or still the same question. And from some statistics that came from the Ohio Board of Education showed that from 1968 to 1975, remember, 76 is the desegregation program. So in those years just before the desegregation, the percentage of white students in Montgomery County enrolled in suburban schools increased 1% per year. So there's a limit going out of Dayton and going into the suburbs at about 1%. That rate of increase jumped to 3% from 75 to 77, and then afterwards it returned back to that 1% rate. Well, if that's true, that is that if the desegregation program brought about an increase of about 3% in the exodus of white students from Dayton to the suburban areas. That is also true about other cities in the United States. Charles Klotfelter, using national data, found the same tendencies in other cities. He argued that it was somewhere between 4 and 6%, that it would increase, and then it would go back to what it had been before. At any rate, the ending of busing did not affect the trend of middle-class people leaving Dayton. What is the culprit? Well, according to that study that I quoted earlier, the one that came from the Miami Valley Planning Commission, the culprit was the state of Ohio's financial system, because that pitted communities against each other, bidding to attract businesses offering, and they would do that by offering tax reductions. Middle-class residents followed the businesses. And at the same time, the region experienced a significant loss of population as industries moved out of Dayton. Did racial desegregation help African-American students? Remember, that was one of the other complaints, was that desegregation did not help African-American students. Well, in 2006, two researchers did a fairly extensive study using extremely sophisticated measures. And what they found was that there were consistent and persistent gaps in academic achievement and also in teenage pregnancy between white students and black students. Desegregation did not solve those problems. However, it did improve the situation of African-American students, at least relative to the position of white students in a similar situation. So racial desegregation didn't bring about dramatic improvement, but it certainly improved it, at least reduced the number of factors which African-American students had to face in order to achieve better in school, to improve school performance. I don't know of any similar study that took place in Dayton, but one would assume that the tendencies would be about the same here. And it is in some ways surprising that attitudes about desegregation changed so dramatically in the absence of evidence that it was causing harm. Nonetheless, people would repeat that it did cause harm and thereby end the program. I want to thank you for your attention, and I want to thank the sponsors of this program for inviting me to participate here. I've had a good time, and I hope you have too. Thank you.
Dr. Joseph Watrous with the University of Dayton. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. The Miami Valley Episcopal Russian Network, or MVRN, was started in 1997 as a cultural exchange partnership with Father Nikolai Aksenov and his parish, St. Nicholas Orthodox Church in Sablino, Russia, a small rural community about 30 miles south of St. Petersburg. MVRN is comprised of 11 Episcopal and 2 Orthodox churches in the Miami Valley. And this week, Nikki Dakota got the chance to speak with exchange leaders and students about the program and their visit. In the interview ahead, you'll meet the students and hear what they have to say with the help of translator Dr. Igor Tolochin, a professor of English at the University of St. Petersburg. Nikki began by asking exchange trip leaders Nick and Joanna McLarnon about their involvement with the program.
We got invited to think about going on one of the youth exchanges. And so in 2008, the two of us went over to Sablino and spent a bunch of time in community center there and had a wonderful time. And so came back and became more active and eventually ended up leading this.
Tell me, Joanna, how did you get involved and what does exchange trip leader mean? What do you do?
Well, I was actually on the same trip with Nicholas in 2008, and we've been 3 times now to Russia together. And I guess what we're doing now is we've put together an itinerary for these kids. They'll be in Dayton for 10 days for Russian students. And we're taking care of their activities and transportation and, sort of just overseeing the whole program for them.
One of the really wonderful things about this trip is the fact that we are not only meeting new friends, but also rekindling and revitalizing friendships. And several of the host families have had students go to Russia. And so, again, there are friendships that are already there that we are, allowing to flourish a little bit more.
All weekend, we've been seeing these reunions happening, people greeting each other who haven't seen each other for a year or two. It's really cool.
Well, thank you so much. And now let's move to the Russian student. He looks nervous. Don't be nervous. Tell him don't be nervous. Yeah, there. And then could we just start by having them introduce themselves and giving us a synopsis of how they became involved in this program?
Ну, сначала вы каждый представитесь и вы вкратце расскажите, каким образом вы стали принимать участие в этой программе, почему, по какой причине.
Ну. No, use your real name.
Или не говори правду, да.
Меня зовут Григорий.
My name is Gregory, Grisha for short.
Мне 17 лет.
And I am 17.
Я поехал в
Америку. I am here because I am a parishioner of St. Nicholas Church in Sablino, St. Petersburg.
Также я являюсь...
And I also happen to be the son of the rector of the church.
So it's my understanding that this was founded in 1997, so it's a big part of his life experience.
Да, когда я родился...
Yes, very true. MVRN existed already before I was born, and it was various partnerships have been going on all this time. So I have always been sensed that MVRN has been around.
Well, it's must be a delight then for you to be able to continue this legacy. And thank you. You speak very well. You shouldn't be nervous.
Ты очень прекрасно говоришь, тебе не нужно нервничать.
Okay. Can we have her come up?
Меня зовут Лена Мурашова. Мне 15 лет.
My name is Lena Murashova. I am 15. And I am part of this exchange because I am also a parishioner of St. Nicholas Church in Sablino, which is part of MVRN. I'm staying with Oksana. It's been very pleasant. They are a very welcoming and friendly family. And even at the moments when we cannot understand each other, because my English is not very good, they are very, very patient, and they are ready to explain everything to me.
Is there something that that is on the plan that stands out to you, what you'll be doing in the next week when you're visiting Dayton?
I'm excited about everything that has been planned for the next week.
Are you glad to be here?
Yeah.
Yeah, she understood. Thank you so much. Will you come up?
Меня зовут Даша Саяпина, и мне 15 лет.
My name is Dasha Sayapina. I am 15.
Oh.
15.
Have you also, has she also always been aware of the existence of this program and looked forward to this opportunity?
Yes, I have been aware of this program for a long time, but I could never believe that I would be part of an actual exchange.
And when did you find out?
Я думаю, около полугода назад.
About half a year ago.
Ну да, я очень радовалась, когда узнала.
I was very, very happy when I heard that news.
So do you learn about Dayton, Ohio in the course of coming up?
Ну да, мы были уже в двух музеях.
We have been to two museums about Dayton.
Мне очень понравилось, узнал много нового.
I have learned a lot of new things about Dayton and Ohio.
Я почитала немножко в Википедии.
I've read a little bit in Wikipedia.
Well, thank you so much for coming. Is there something that you're looking forward to in particular with this visit?
King's Island.
I would like to go to King's Island.
I heard that. I even understood that. Yeah, yes. We should all go. That's great. Well, thank you so much. And our final student.
Меня зовут Наталья Шакулова.
My name is Наталья Шакулова. I am 16.
So have you always wanted to be involved in this program? Have you always known of it and thought that this would be a great opportunity?
Да, я узнала об этом в 2008 году, когда
Yes, I learned about it in 2008, and I met a lot of American youth who came over to Sabino.
Мне самой захотелось принять в этом участие.
And of course, then I really started thinking about how nice it would be to be a part of it.
Do you get a sense of comparison of the two cities? What do you find to be similar and what do you find to be different?
Ну, это слишком разные.
I think they're really very, very different, and it's hard to compare them. Dayton seems to be very modern, whereas St. Petersburg is all history.
You know, it occurs to me that I would love to hear a quick comparison from the other students one more time, if everyone would be willing to come up and say.
Основные различия, мне кажется, то, что в России у нас люди не такие дружелюбные.
The main difference is that in Russia the people are not so friendly to each other.
А здесь каждый человек открыт для нас.
Everybody here seems to be so open and friendly.
Также я согласен с Наташей, что люди идут совершенно другие.
I agree with Natasha that the people are very different from Russia. It seems that our mentalities are very different. Also, with people apart, I must say that the whole environment is very different. I'm talking about the roads, the stores, the buildings. Everything seems to be more different rather than similar. I like things here better than there.
I was going to say, will he hope to come back?
I would like to come here over and over again and keep coming.
Very good. Thank you very much. She's being pushed forward.
Ну да.
Americans seem to be much more devoted to their families.
И я ни разу не видела, чтобы допустим, дети или подростки ссорились со своими родителями.
I've never seen the parents and their teenage children at odds with each other. And I also think that the young people really respect their parents and the families seem to be very friendly.
Very good. And would she hope to return?
А ты бы хотела еще сюда приехать?
Да, конечно.
Of course.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
Я согласна с Гришей, что у нас просто разные менталитеты, но несмотря на это мы подружились.
I agree with Grisha when he said that our mentalities are very different, and yet in spite of that, we're getting on well and we can be friends.
Well, it's good to know that we can be that different and still get along. The young Russians had agreed to sing a song.
The Russian kids always sing the Lord's Prayer, saying grace before meals or at the beginning of any events during this exchange, and that's what they do in their home church at home, and that's what they're going to do now.
Very good. The Lord's Prayer in Russian on
91.3. Да светится имя Твое, да приидет царствие Твое, да будет воля Твоя, яко на небеси и на земли. Хлеб наш насущный дашь нам несть, и остави нам долги наши, яко же и мы оставляем должником нашим. И не веди нас
Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you. Thanks for making this happen. And enjoy Dayton.
Catch you later.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
How do you say thank you in Russian?
Spasibo.
Siba. I recognize that.
What's
do
svidaniya then? What's that?
Goodbye.
Oh, goodbye. Do svidaniya.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all our guests. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.